this one, Miles.
You are listening to The Business Called Cricket, only on Red Podcast.
Lisa Sthalika, thank you very, very much for joining me on this podcast, The Business Called Cricket. To tell my listeners about you, you were the number one women's all-rounder when the rankings were introduced in 2008. You have 4 World Cups under your belt, and that's an incredible CV. But Lisa, you know, we will talk about your cricketing achievements, which has made you so very famous. What I have always been intrigued about is a doe-eyed Maharashtrian girl with an Australian accent. Can you tell us a little more about that girl?
Yeah, sure. I was born in Pune. I was actually adopted. My father's from Bombay, lived in Gumdevi. His wife was a white English lady who he met when he was studying over in England. And they adopted my older sister from Bangalore, and then they adopted me 6 years later. So through my father's work, we travelled to America, Kenya, and then settled in Australia when I was 4 years of age.
Mm-hmm. And your parents, when they adopted you, while you were growing up, they always let you know that you were adopted, and there was no Bollywood drama being unveiled at 21, saying that, you know, we didn't tell you all these years, but here's what your story is.
Yeah, no, as long as I can remember, I was always told that I was adopted. So it was never a big thing or a big deal for me. It just meant that I had an interesting story compared to the rest of my school friends.
Mm-hmm. Lisa, I was flipping through the pages of this book called Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls, 100 yep. Immigrant Women Who Changed the World. And you feature in one of those 100 immigrant women who changed the world. Tell me, what is the biggest change that you have been able to bring about so far?
I've been fortunate to be part of very successful teams, but probably the one of the most proudest things that I was associated with was pushing for the female players within Australia to be part of the Players Association. At the time, it was only for male cricketers. They had to change the constitution to have females. And because of that involvement with the Players Association, it meant that the female players had a voice. It wasn't them going to their employer, so to speak, and asking for better environment, better training facilities, better remuneration, things like that. There was someone representing us. And because of that in 2017, so that kind of started, that all started around 2008, 2009. And then 2017, there was an MOU deal, which was one of the first in the world where the females came under the same contract and were part of a revenue share model, which is pretty vital in funding the sport that we do, but paying the players appropriately as well.
Lisa, are you still one of those who's fighting for equal pay? Well, the conversations pretty much began from the time you were a part of the Australian cricket team. Now that you've moved on from, being a player into the commentator's box, is that a conversation even now in your domain? Do you or do you not get paid equivalent to a male commentator?
I don't get paid the same amount as majority of commentators, but the pay is still a hell of a lot better than it was when I was playing. I'm fortunate enough to travel around the world and live a very comfortable life. So I don't necessarily have complaints. This MOU deal, which I spoke about, it has a formula in it, so it's the first one of its kind from an equity point of view. So to break it down, basically the hourly rate of Tim Payne is the same as Meg Lanning, who are the Australian men's and women's captain. But obviously Tim Payne trains a lot more and tours a lot more, and in that formula is broadcast rights and things like that. So that's why their pay is obviously still a lot more, significantly more than the females, because they just don't play as much as well. But we are seeing things change dramatically anyway. So I'm a big believer that females should be paid the same amount for the same work. So that's why I like this model that we've adopted in Australia, because the females, I don't think, should get paid the same amount because they're not travelling 11 months of the year, whereas the male players are.
And Lisa, as you say this, I hope BCCI is listening to it, because there has been huge scheduling issues with the BCCI women's team ever since they came back after that phenomenal final they played in Australia in front of an 86,000 crowd in MCG. Since you follow cricket across the globe, I'm talking about women's cricket here, Lisa, which is the best structured unit in terms of women's cricket right now, logistics and functional, in terms of being robust practices in place and also providing facilities to the players? Which is the best unit, which is the best board that does so?
Yeah, it would certainly be Australia, hands down, simply because we've got a good structure. Our female players are the best paid across the globe, but also we have a domestic structure. They're still seen as semi-professional, but they can earn on average around $40,000 Australian dollars. And we're hoping in the next year or two that they will come up to a salary of 80 plus, which means that their professional cricket is at a domestic level. So that means no one has to work if they don't want to. No one has to find the odd job to try and support what they're doing. Because remember, in Australia, kids, once they turn a certain age, they tend to go out and live by themselves. So they're not living in the family home. So there's bills to pay rent, mortgage, all sorts of things. So I know England cricket have only just started to bring in domestic contracts. And even then it's for a smaller group of people, whereas we've probably got about 900 female players that are on semi-professional or professional contracts. So, yeah, Australia is hands down leading the way, and that's why it's no surprise that Australia has dominated over the last decade or so, even before that, because our structures have always been strong. So a young girl in rural Australia grows up seeing the WBBL on TV and goes, right, there's a path for me, and I want to represent Australia. So you can't be what you can't see. And mm-hmm. I guess that's the argument here in India, that your Indian women's side is not playing enough cricket and is not being televised, and also an argument around the women's IPL as well.
Right. Also, Lisa, the Australian cricket, the young Australian women cricketers have role models like you. Would you say the revolution in terms of cricket really begins with the results that are produced on the field? Today, we have a Shefali Varma because a road for Shefali Varma was created.
Yeah, I think you can't necessarily wait for performances to then decide to start to invest. In any kind of business, you have to invest at the start to get things going. And then mm-hmm. once it's going, then you can reap the rewards. So women's cricket is exactly the same. You can't expect them. For instance, everyone's been quite critical of their performances against South Africa, but they haven't played for over a year. They haven't even trained.
Right.
And then you criticise their performances and say, well, actually, I've heard some things, we're not going to four teams in the women's exhibition matches because the performances weren't good in South Africa. So you've already hampered them by not playing, allowing them to play or train for a year, and then you judge them on their performances. I think that's probably a little bit unfair.
When you look at this current Indian unit, who are the ones you think are the most promising and the faces for the future?
Well, I certainly think the T20 squad that toured Australia for that T20 mm-hmm. World Cup are exciting prospects, because one thing I've known over the years is that in order for teams to be successful, you need a good blend of youth and experience. The average age of the T20 squad is probably in the mid-20s, but you've got players like a Harmanpreet Kaur, Shikhar Pandey, Veda Krishnamurti. You've got those type of players that are at the, you know, the pointier end of their career, and then you've got someone like Shefali Verma, Richa Ghosh. Even when the WBBL started, we went from 6 state sides to 8 franchises, 8 teams. And we were worried about the depth. But after maybe a year of unearthing young cricketers, all of a sudden those cricketers were tapping on the Australian door and making their debut, you know, before they turned 20. So it has its benefit.
Lisa, when we look at the international cricketing firmament today, who would you say is the brightest star and, you know, you will have your eyes on for the next maybe 5 years or 10 years?
Yeah, well, I guess the brightest star at the moment and the peak age of normally female cricketers is early 30s. So someone like an Elisa Healy, Sophie Devine, they're certainly leading the way, but I've got a lot of admiration for the South African side. I think someone like Alora Fulfart, got a lot of skill, a lot of talent. So the great thing is it's not just one or two players within each country that is dominating. There's more and more players, so and there are more teams that are coming through the ranks. So someone like a South Africa, you know, 5-6 years ago, we're just still developing, whereas now they're one of the top teams that could potentially win the World Cup next year. So there is a long list of players that people should look out for. So I can't name them all.
You know, what I was really intrigued by when I was covering the World Cup in Australia was the presence of the Thai players. You know, we don't have a Thai men's team in playing top level cricket, but they were there in T20 cricket. So do you think that T20 format for women is the best way to expand the game globally?
Yeah, I think so. And I don't think it's just women's cricket. I think it's men's cricket as well. Because what it does is it brings those countries a little bit closer together to the teams and the countries that have been playing cricket a lot longer. Also, T20 cricket is a shortened form, 3 hours. You can capture new audience, which is why T20 cricket has grown as much as it has over the last, 15 years or so. So, yeah, you're going to see teams like Thailand within the women's setup, but you're also going to see teams from South America and all sorts of things take up the game. And I wouldn't be surprised if T20 cricket is something that over in the States it starts to take effect as well.
And do you see there are prospects of this featuring in the Commonwealth Games you know, women, particularly the ones who've been there long enough, have the ability to even get Commonwealth Games medals and make a podium finish?
Yeah, well, it actually is. Women's cricket T20 is in the next Commonwealth Games in Birmingham. So that's definitely happening. And then there's always been discussions about trying to get cricket in the ICC, in the Olympic Games as well. So certainly it makes a lot of sense to have it in the Commonwealth Games, given that I guess it is a Commonwealth sport. Yeah, definitely Birmingham Games are going to be really crucial. And if it's successful, I guess ICC and the national bodies will be keen to ensure that it continues.
Lisa, once you finished this sport, you took to commentating. I do know that you conduct coaching in New South Wales, but did you ever think that the option could be between becoming a full-time coach and becoming a commentator and, you know, commentary then was more important to you, or commentary took precedence over coaching?
Whilst I was playing, I was working full-time as a high-performance coach within Cricket New South Wales. So I'm a level 3 coach. I first met Elisa Healy and Elise Perry when they were 13-year-olds, 12, 13.
I did see that video. Yes, it is very cute.
yeah.
of you interacting with them. Yes.
Yeah. So I've been coaching for as long as I've been playing, pretty much. But when I retired from playing the game, I wanted another challenge. There was a pathway set for me to coach at a high performance level, but I had a bit of an issue because I'd already coached all of these young girls coming through the programs. Then they became my teammates, and then you wanted me to coach them again. I just didn't think that that would be appropriate. but at that stage, there were really no females within the commentary game, in the commentary circle. And I certainly felt that females have an opinion, females watch the game, females enjoy the game. Why can't there be a female voice bringing them the all of the action? So that's when I started to set out and try and break through into the commentary world.
I'll ask you a little more about commentary, but before that, here's something I really want to know. Have you ever thought of coaching another country? And even for that matter, becoming the Indian women's team's coach?
Well, I do have an OCI, so I think that makes me eligible to potentially have a job within BCCI, I think. I certainly feel that I love my commentary and I really enjoy that. I love being involved in a team setup. I love working with individual athletes. I'm actually still coaching on, it's called slowcoach.com.
Right.
So it's a coaching platform, so I can still work with individuals around the world, even though I'm not there. So I'd love to be able to share my learnings and help out people and individuals and groups. So I don't know if I'd ever want to be a head coach, to be honest, because I think in this day and age it's a tough gig. You know, you live and die by the sword of or the performances of your players, and
true.
Sometimes you get canned pretty quick, and then you've got to. Whereas I certainly enjoy commentary, it still allows me to be heavily involved in the game, but certainly to be able to give back to players and help them, that's something that I've always been very keen and happy to do.
Was taking to commentary natural for you? Was it an organic transition?
No, I wanted to commentate. I had an experience of five overs where I sat between Tony Gregg and Mark Nicklaus, and I really enjoyed it. And I thought, this is a pretty good gig. How do I get this after I finish? So I definitely pursued it with that vision in mind. But as I said, there were no females involved, and it was literally when you get thrown into the commentary box, there's no 101 manual of how to commentate, and you're thrown in the deep end. So if you can talk and talk about the game and be able to articulate what's going on the field and help add to the pictures, then it helps. So no doubt my first few years I would have been terrible to listen, but thankfully people are still doing the job, and I think the public now enjoy what I've been able to bring.
You're an absolute delight on the mic, I can tell you that. And people in India, they listen to you with a lot of intent, and there's a great deal of interest in wanting to know whether you will be back on IPL commentary this summer as well.
I will. I'll be in Chennai covering the games.
Oh, fantastic. Liza, let me ask you, a few months back, Jeffrey Boycott had said there is room for women in commentating, fronting as presenters and reporters. Many are excellent, such as Gabby Logan, Alison Mitchell and Claire Balding. But as an expert summarizer in men's cricket, you need to have only men out there in the middle. How do you react to that?
Well, I did react to that in an article, which I, which was published, and I said, "Well, the point is that you're there to explain what happens." Now, so I guess the same thing could apply for all of these commentators, male commentators that have never played a T20 game. How do they know the pace of the game? How do they understand the tactics when they've never played it? Yet they've been commentating T20 cricket since it started, and hardly any of them, apart from the new generation, have played it. So that argument doesn't stand up. The point is, for a good expert or colour analysis is able to explain why things are happening and can explain what the player might be going through. So even though I've never faced 145 kilometers an hour delivery, I faced 125, close to 130. That's still quick enough. So my fear or my thought process no doubt would be very similar to someone facing 145. So why can't I give you my opinion or impression of that? So as you can see, Jeffrey Boycott's opinions isn't the way the environment is going from a broadcast point of view. The broadcasters have finally realized they can't just have males voices on the game because so many females are part of it. So why not replicate and have diversity within the commentary box? Because no doubt there is diversity in the living room that is watching the game.
Absolutely. And I couldn't agree more with you on that. Because when I started out as a broadcaster, as a sports reporter, I was often asked if I knew what the offside rule was. And I would have my answers ready for that. I just found that was condescending when I was asked what is the offside rule. But having said that, I need to ask you, who is your favorite cricket commentator? Is there anyone you look up to and you would like to listen to again and again and again?
Well, I mean, I've been really fortunate enough to commentate with some of the best in the business. And I think what makes a good commentary team is that, you have some diverse people, so you're not all the same. And, you know, some of the commentary box, so last IPL that I was part of was in Abu Dhabi, and my commentary team was Harsha Bogle, Ian Bishop, Danny Morrison, myself, Deep Dasgupta, and JP Duminy. And we had an absolute ball. We all helped each other out. We all come from different backgrounds, different skill sets, and we genuinely enjoyed each other's company. And if we're having fun in the commentary box, hopefully it's coming across as well. So I can't name one or two or three because, to be honest, I've been very blessed with who I've worked with, and they've all been very welcoming and accepting.
Lisa, you mentioned that you sat in the comm box with Tony Greig and Mark Nicholas. Now, that must have been some time back. With the evolution of the game, your job must have also changed. I mean, commentary, the way commentary is done, the way it's delivered. Also, COVID has induced certain changes. Could you tell me, how did you experience the change and what is it that you had to change along the way?
Well, firstly, that five overs I did was in 2010, and then I didn't really get into the commentary box until 2014 and then properly 2015. Okay. So obviously I've been learning on the job for the first few years, but what I've noticed is depending on where you go and where you travel, there's a different expectation of the feel of the commentary. So in IPL, it's all about being, getting excited, lots of talking. You literally come on for five overs. Whereas at home at the Big Bash, there's three of us and we're there for the whole game. So there's no need to jump in if you don't have anything to say, or it's conversational, like you're on the couch talking to your mates about the game. Whereas IPL is a bit more professional, slick, and you come in, you give your information, and then you go out. Obviously, WBBL and women's cricket, because I know the players a little bit more intimately, it's storytelling. And then the longer format, you've got a chance to get into stories. But obviously, I do a lot of T20 cricket. How the game has changed? Well, I mean, we've got different rules coming in, so it's constantly keeping ahead of that and being able to explain that to the viewers. And just different people. So obviously in Australia we have a lot of current players that come in and commentate when they're not playing, and for them it's a new experience. So trying to help them to feel comfortable and get the best out of them. So once upon a time it was someone trying to get the best out of me and get me better, and hopefully I've now transitioned a little bit more into helping others that are new to the commentary box.
Lisa, one final question. Since you will be here commentating on the IPL, your favorite team for this edition? We know Mumbai Indians have been incredible. They have been the most dominant team. But how do you see things shaping up this year?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's going to be dependent on how the pitchers play, to be honest. As we all know, teams kind of select their squad based on home conditions, but no one's going to be playing at home. And we saw in the UAE, conditions played a huge role. For instance, Chennai Super Kings didn't perform as well as they would have liked because their squad is based on the slower turning track of Chepauk. So, So I think we're going to have to wait until the kind of the first week of IPL is done to see where teams are at. Obviously, Delhi Capitals is a team to look out for, but with Shreyas Iyer now out completely, that changes the dynamics. They have to find a new captain. So all of these things will play an important role of how a team is able to kind of progress, whereas Mumbai Indians seem to have kept the core group, haven't they? And they know how to play in tough conditions. You know, the fact that someone like Krunal Pandya has come into the one-day setup and performed really well, he'll take a lot of confidence going into the IPL. So Mumbai Indians look a tough side to beat before a match has even started, but you never know. Funny game.
Indeed, cricket is a very, very funny game. Lisa, it's such a pleasure talking to you, and I can't wait to listen to you once again in the IPL commentary box. Thank you very much for your time.
No worries.
Always hit this one, Miles.
You were listening to The Business Called Cricket, only on Red Podcast.